You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
She's got moxie, and she knows how to use it. Your late night, highly caffeinated host, the one and only smoking artist, Allison Brenner.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Allison Bricker Show here on Daily Paul Radio. I am, of course, your host, Allison Bricker, broadcasting live from the Constitution Free Zone, the frozen Constitution Free Zone, as we're expecting to receive another 6 to 10 inches of snow. This is exactly the kind of winter I've always wanted. Here in the first hour, I get to speak to, and this is why I love doing my show, is because I get to speak to someone who I have held in very high esteem for at least 20 years. He is a very prolific writer. He is the vice president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, former editor of The Freeman. We're going to be speaking with the one and only Sheldon Richmond. Mr. Richmond, thank you so much for coming on to the show this evening. It is an honor to get to speak with you.
Well, Allison, it's great to be with you. Please call me Sheldon, and I what can I say? That was a wonderful introduction.
Ah, no problem, Sheldon. Well, you have been someone I have been reading for about 20 years. I remember probably the first time I ever saw your name was in 1993. We received out of the blue in the mail a copy of The Freeman. And I remember my mother was worried that we were going to be blacklisted on some sort of government list. She was a 1960s anti-war hippie. And I can't imagine if she was alive today what she would think of the current state. So you are one of the few people who are just excellent pretty much across the board. So, again, I am so happy to be speaking with you.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be on your program.
What had me reach out to you via Facebook was your article over at Counterpunch regarding the detractors of Edward Snowden, pretty much how fearful, because that's what I keep, that's what seems to be the reoccurring theme with Edward Snowden. On a scale of 1 to 10, how scared do you think the national security state is simply by him still breathing in Russia?
I think they're shaking every day in their boots because they don't know what may come down next. Yeah, he's their greatest nightmare, and it's funny how it's affected people like the subject of my article that you just mentioned, Professor Sean Wilentz of Princeton, a historian of Princeton University, who wrote his own article about how progressives, he's speaking to his progressive colleagues, warning them not to embrace Snowden and Glenn Greenwald and Julian Assange of WikiLeaks because, oh my gosh, these people don't share our vision of a big welfare warfare state. And so why would we hold these people up as heroes? And it was hilarious. I mean, here he is. He's willing to forgive NSA snooping on every American without probable cause, gathering up all kinds of data about their phone calls and emails, etc. And he's willing to overlook all that because the people that are disclosing this to us, gosh, don't share his agenda for big government. I had to laugh. It was almost like something out of The Onion.
Exactly. That is so true. But as they say, you only take flack when you're over the target. And when I picture Edward Snowden and the revelations published by Greenwald, I can't help but see it as a bowling ball analogy, as him just completely knocking down the Straussian mindset of this overbearing police state following, you know, post 9/11 America that we heard over and over again. And do you view him as kind of a modern day Paul Revere? Do you think his impact will be viewed in a historical lens as just astounding? And what we do, we don't know yet, but the revelations in themselves.
Right. Well, I hope so. It's hard to say. I hope historians will look back on this as a great day. I mean, of course, Daniel Ellsberg is celebrated as a hero by lots and lots of people, and probably wasn't seen quite that way back in the 70s when he was giving the New York Times the Pentagon Papers. But these days, I think he's got a fairly favorable, view in people's eyes. So I'm hoping the same thing will be true of Snowden and the others. I wish they would release more stuff. I think they should just dump it like WikiLeaks likes to do instead of parceling it out. It's funny you should mention Paul Revere, because another one of the very funny things that I had to laugh about was the opening sentence or two that, of Obama's speech on about the NSA, the so-called reforms of the NSA, where he compared the NSA to Paul Revere and the Sons of Liberty in Massachusetts back in the 1770s. He acted like the NSA and Clapper are the Paul Reveres of today. How ironic! I mean, if King George had the NSA, he would have been spying on Paul Revere and the Sons of Liberty and the other people that were hoping to separate from England and safeguard their liberty that way. And yet here was Obama twisting it, insulting our intelligence by thinking he could make us believe that it's the NSA that are the champions of individual freedom.
Absolutely. But again, I mean, well, the 44th executive occupying the White House, this is a man who claimed to be a constitutional lawyer. To me, it really is par for the course, like with this Orwellian doublespeak. I mean, everything the guy said during his OA run, even and all of his speeches, it really is just the opposite of reality. In that, I didn't listen to the whole interview with O'Reilly, but he flat out denies that anything at all is going on with the IRS. I mean, the level of cognitive dissonance you have to train yourself to be able to endure, to go on television and say something so patently false, is rather shocking.
Yes, he's very smooth. And these days, I'm not thinking he's quite as smart as I used to think he was. But I just don't. Look, presidents tend to be smooth because you don't get to that position without having some skills at campaigning, which means pulling the wool over people's eyes. That's what a campaign is. It's a form of theater, and so we shouldn't be surprised that any occupant of the White House will tend to be a smooth operator. But he's particularly calm, cool, and collected, but it's amazing what he thinks he can get away with. Him, and he's not long ago he was pledging or expressing his great confidence in James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, who everybody knows is a liar. It's not a secret. It's not a conspiracy theory. The guy lied to the Congress and in front of the American people when he said that the NSA was not gathering data on hundreds of millions of Americans. He said, when he was asked that by Ron Wyden in a Senate committee meeting, even when he had advanced knowledge of the question, he said no, period, no. Now, in the follow-up, when he was asked, are you sure, or something like that, he said not wittingly. But his first answer was no. Now, of course, we know they do it wittingly, too, so that was a double lie. And yet Obama has expressed great confidence in Clapper. Clapper's still on the job. He's not going anywhere. Now he's in front of Congress warning that one of the factions in Syria has aspirations to attack the United States. Why would we believe anything these guys say? Come on, how many times do we have to be burned?
Right, yeah, I know. I always look to the free market. I imagine, like, if the government was a car, and you purchased this car and it was a piece of garbage and fell apart every single time that you started it, how many times would you continue to go back to that same brand to purchase another car? And it's whether it's the war on drugs, the war on poverty, the war on terror, everything they've said, we now have a litany of 100 years of lies from them. As we get farther along into this century, we'll have more and more documentation, audio and video evidence of their lies. Why do people, have you ever been able to come with an idea of why people continue to believe this murderous, lying U.S. government?
That's going to be an eternal mystery. Look, most people go through the government schools, so there's where they start down this crooked path, right? The indoctrination in the government schools, and the private schools are not much different. They have to satisfy government regulations, and so the history lessons are going to be essentially the same, which is propaganda for the state. The state is good, so people grow up believing that, and it's very hard to it takes some initiative to look for things that challenge the world you grew up with. It's uncomfortable. People don't normally like to do that, so most people don't. And so they were brought up believing the government is essentially benign. And you're right. No matter how many lemons they quote unquote buy when they vote for somebody, or when they, you know, they see the government in action, they hope the next time they'll get it right. And yet, you know, it's funny how people disparage the marketplace versus government. But in the marketplace, if you have a lemon, like you said, you can take the product back, get your money back. What do you do when you get lemon after lemon of presidents and congressmen and senators and judges and all these people, mayors and governors and state legislators? You get lemon after lemon. You have no recourse at all. They'll say, yeah, well, you can wait for the next election and vote. So you get one vote out of, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions, which makes no difference. It's like a drop in the ocean.
Absolutely.
So you individually have zero power, zero say, and so you have zero recourse. I mean, give me the marketplace anytime.
Absolutely. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, we're speaking with Sheldon Richman, Vice President of the Future of Freedom Foundation. You're listening to the Alison Bricker Show here on Daily Paul Radio. We'll be right back. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Alison Bricker Show here on Daily Paul Radio, where we bring you revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. I am speaking with the one and only Sheldon Richman, Vice President of the Future of Freedom Foundation, also the editor. Sheldon, right before the break, you had mentioned, well, a little earlier, before the break, that you were happy, you were kind of wishing that actually Snowden and Greenwald would just kind of dump all of the documents, and you made reference to WikiLeaks. Now, I've said in the past that I kind of see their strategy here, because I remember with the WikiLeaks diplomatic cables, they were all dumped at once, and there was so much to go through. I don't think the full impact of those was really understood. Do you appreciate, like, how, I mean, with this strategy, it seems that the NSA is never out of the headlines, because it's almost, what, every 2 weeks, we're getting another story about the NSA.
That's a good point. What I was referring to was there were some statements by Snowden and Greenwald that, and also the editor of The Guardian, that led me to believe that they weren't even intending to release everything. In other words, they were going through things to sort of vet them. Not that they were just simply parceling them out. I can kind of understand that to make it manageable, but that they were actually not planning to release everything. They were deciding what was, I think they used the phrase, in the public interest. So that's a little bit like, you know, the government deciding what information is ought to be released, if it's in the public interest or not. So that's what I was referring to. Not so much the parceling it out piece by piece.
Right on. That makes sense. But let me ask you this. I mean, you have more experience in journalism than I do. Is that common, though, like for the New York Times or the Washington Post? Don't they normally decide, like, they don't ever, did they publish everything with Ellsberg, or what, how did that work back in the 70s?
As far as I know, and I'm not probably not the best person to ask on this, I think they did. I think everything that Ellsberg released was published. Maybe there was some stuff that was, you know, truly minor and that had no bearing. I can't say that for sure. Now, you know, the other side might argue, or the Greenwald might argue, or some of the people have said that, well, the Pentagon Papers was different because it was historical. You know, it was past history about Vietnam and showing how Johnson, persisted, even though they knew that there was no way they could even accomplish their own ends. But it was purely historical, and while I say that the NSA stuff is current, you know, it's been an ongoing program and all that, so some people have drawn a distinction there. But you're right. I think the Washington Post, the New York Times, and others, in fact, and I don't like this either, when they've gotten leaks, they've actually worked with the government and held off publishing things under advice from the government, and that makes me uncomfortable. I don't know. I don't think newspapers, if they're getting leaks from the inside, should then go to the administration and say, hey, what do you think of this? And then the administration puts pressure on them to say, hold off. I believe sometimes as much as a year, newspapers have held off publishing material because the government has told them. That seems to compromise their independence.
Absolutely it does. I mean, they're supposed to be charged as being the fourth estate, the watchdog on the central authority. And I believe that was the case with the Washington Post, just with the torture memos back during the Bush era. They were sitting on them for quite some time, as well as, as you point out, the New York Times did the same thing with a lot of the Iranian yellow cake memos. They sat on those stories for a while. And that does bring into question whether or not they're, at least in my mind, they're a reliable source for getting hard-hitting journalism. Did you see the video of Guardian editors destroying the hard drives? And what did you make?
No.
You didn't? I can't even understand what it is. They had a picture. I guess they were showing to prove to the government they destroyed the hard drives. They were cutting them up and smashing them with sledgehammers in it. I thought,
that's horrible.
Yeah, what the heck?
I don't like that.
What is this? I mean, it's really kind of a bizarre thing to publish to YouTube. Here's the destruction of all your horrible secrets.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it was the editor of The Guardian that said that no more than 1% of those that information was going to be published. So that's very small, obviously.
Well, let's hope the Greenwald's partner, who was held and charged with terrorism for having a USB stick, hopefully something got through there. And when they reunited in Brazil, hopefully something is still together, because I would hate to think that the only copy was destroyed on that stupid video that The Guardian uploaded.
Yeah, that seems unlikely. Yeah, I can't believe they would have set it up that way. So, I'm with you on that, definitely.
So let me ask you, how did Sheldon Richmond become Sheldon Richmond? Did you grow up in, like, a conservative household or a liberal household? And was there a defining moment that said, you said, whoa, this government stuff is all a fairy tale?
I didn't grow up in a terribly political house, mildly Republican, you know, very mildly conservative, I think, but not very ideological. And so my political awakening occurred in 1964 with the Goldwater campaign. And, you know, Goldwater was saying some things that I guess you could say had a libertarian tone to it. Looking back on that campaign, I think a lot less of it than I did then. That just shows you that, you know, that I've learned a bit over the years. But it was the beginning. It was important because it was the beginning of my political consciousness. And so I knew people at school who would say, well, if you're interested in that, here's a book you should read, Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. Which is very often a book given to people who express interest in libertarian views and free market views. And so, well, you know, once you start with that, that's like a gateway drug, right? You know, once you're on the road, once you've read Henry Hazlitt, because then you want to read more. And people said, well, you need to read Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard, and of course, Ayn Rand gets thrown in. And then I was starting to see, as I got into college, I started seeing going to conferences and seeing people like Carl Hess, who ironically, of course, was an advisor, speechwriter to Goldwater, but he wasn't a libertarian yet. I mean, he was sort of headed that way, but it was afterwards that he became really a radical libertarian. And so, you know, I just started reading these people and meeting these people, and the rest is history.
Actually, you know, it was kind of the same way for me. I grew up very much in a very political household. It was my mother and my grandmother constantly at the kitchen table drinking obscene amounts of coffee and smoking obscene amounts of cigarettes and just constantly talking about politics. But we grew up, my parents worked in the trucking industry, so Republicans were bad and Democrats were for the working class. And I remember my mother was very upset with Reagan. She was not a fan of Reagan at all, but... Mm-hmm. The thing that really my gateway drug was Harry Brown's Why Government Doesn't Work. And I guess my point is that it's always an actual, like, literal work. Nobody ever says, here, you want to learn more about government and the truth of society. Here's a government school book. I mean, all of the authors you just mentioned, pretty much everybody that I've read from the time of my graduation from a government school, never got scant a mention in any of the textbooks. And I really don't chalk up my learning until after graduation out of government school.
No, that's a good point. That certainly mirrors my experience. I can't recall coming into contact with good free market thinking or libertarian political thinking in any of my classes. Economics, I only took one economics class in college. It was a typical Keynesian, you know, introduction to Keynesianism, and that was presented as economics. And I didn't, and in all my philosophy courses, political philosophy, I didn't run into the people that I mentioned. So you have to learn it on your own. And it's a tribute to, you know, as Twain said, never let the schooling interfere with your education.
Absolutely. And, that's so right on. He was, of course, excellent. But I mean, the only time I ever, the thing that really kind of shoved me towards a more liberty direction was I remember one quip to this day that was in like chapter review of chapter 9 of Thomas Paine saying, "My rights end where your rights begin." And there was a small section on nullification, probably about a paragraph. But outside of that, I mean, it is. It's kind of a tribute to the way the founding generation learned, which was through books and through sharing ideas in the big conversation. We're speaking with Sheldon Richman, Vice President of the Future of Freedom Foundation, here on the Allison Bricker Show. We'll be right back after the bottom of the hour news.
You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Allison Bricker Show here on Daily Paul Radio. Make sure you check us out over at dailypaul.com. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/DailyPaulRadio. You can also listen right there. You don't even have to be logged in at dailypaul.com to access the stream. So share with your friends, family. The NSA, they usually download the streams back up somewhere around 9. We are speaking with the one and only Sheldon Richman from the Future of Freedom Foundation. Before we went to the break, we were kind of discussing political backgrounds. So, Sheldon, you had mentioned that all we basically get these days are one or two options, one member from the left wing of the war party and one member from the right wing of the war party, as Scott Horton likes to call them. Do you still vote? Where are you today on the political spectrum?
Well, I haven't voted since 1980, so it's been a while. I think I'd get lost if I got to a polling place. I wouldn't recognize it. I felt that, every time when I used to go, I needed a real shower afterwards, and it was just a pain, so I stopped. And by the way, I voted for the Libertarian in 1980. If anybody's curious, I didn't vote. I wasn't voting for Ronald Reagan. I consider myself a left libertarian, and a lot of people don't understand what I mean by that. And that term gets used in different senses, so I should be clear. But so I'm a libertarian. I'm for complete separation of state and economy. I'm for complete separation of state and reality, I guess I should say. So I'm for the free market. I'm for all kinds of voluntary exchange and voluntary social cooperation, mutual aid societies, fraternal societies. That's what I think ought to be taking place, not coerced relationships. And the word left in front of that would describe, a lot of libertarians, most libertarians, I suppose. But the word left in front of that is to show that there are historical concerns that the left has voiced, which are legitimate concerns. It's just that they misdiagnosed, in many cases, they misdiagnosed the cause of the problems. So, historically, there's been a problem where working people often didn't have choices and options, except to, go to work in the factory. Historically, women obviously had legal disabilities. They didn't have the full rights of men in past times. Racism, the usual isms that the left points to. These things were problems, not as much today, but there's still vestiges here and there. But what the left libertarian says is that much of that was sustained by the by government, by the state, because, you know, there are always power relations, and the well-connected are able to get the state to bolster, you know, their particular preferences. So the way to liberate people is to reduce state power, roll back state power, get rid of the state power and all of its manifestations, rather than grow the state and have it more and more in control of things, which is the way some leftists have, the way they wanted to go. So we hark back, the left, people call themselves left libertarians, my colleagues hark back to an earlier American libertarians from the late 19th century and into the 20th century, Benjamin Tucker, before him, although they were colleagues for a while, Lysander Spooner, and the people around the magazine known as Liberty Magazine, which published until early in the 20th century. These guys were good, hardcore libertarians. I disagree with some of the things, some of their views on economics. I think they made some errors, but nevertheless, largely very sound. And they understood that these social pathologies that we sometimes observe, you know, often have their roots in the state, and the way to fight them, therefore, is to roll back state power.
Right on. I mean, when I was growing up, I remember asking my mother why was liberal viewed with such disdain. Even when I was young, I thought liberal merely meant like open-minded and tolerant. And I think you're describing well a left libertarian, or would you even say like a classical liberal in the Jeffersonian sense, that these were your abolitionists, these were the ones that were trying to stop, as you correctly point out, the racism that was inbred into the system, was inbred through notions from the federal government, whether it was the fugitive slave law or, you know, Jim Crow South. This was the problem, and that the state wasn't the answer. When did it all switch around and we end up having more kind of this neoliberal kind of view now that we see? I see a lot of my liberal friends trying to defend, yeah, the state does a bad job, but they're trying, so it's better than handing it over to a bunch of evil Republicans. When did liberals surrender? Was that FDR, and it's just kind of been a snowball downhill since then?
Well, the word started transforming earlier than that, earlier in the 20th century, but you're quite right. The word begins, when it's first being used politically, it means very much what we mean by libertarian. They wanted it was against absolute monarchy. It was against pervasive government and pro-market, which means when you say pro-market, you mean pro-voluntary exchange, pro-social cooperation through the division of labor and trade and other forms of consensual relations. So that's what it meant. Today we have to say classical liberal to distinguish it from, you know, Ted Kennedy-style liberal. And so the word gets changed. Herbert Spencer had a theory for why the word got changed, that the original liberals, which we would regard as the good guys, pointed out that by adopting liberal methods, the masses would be uplifted. In other words, people would be free and then go on to become more and more prosperous. And but then some thinkers in England originally started making mistakes, thinking, well, if our goal, they forgot that the making everybody better off was not so much the immediate goal, but was going to be the consequence of freeing people. And they forgot that, and they said, well, why don't we just directly act to make people better off, forgetting the freedom part of the link, right? Just going right to, let's make people better off. And that led them into errors. And, you know, maybe good faith in some cases, maybe not good faith in other cases. They then decided to bolster state power in the name of making people better off, forgetting the original liberal case that freedom, they'll be better off if they're freed. They forgot the freed part, and they said, you know, jump to the let's make them better off. And you can see how you then end up getting, you know, welfare-style programs. But there was always a dark side to that agenda. I mean, a lot of welfare, going back even to Queen Elizabeth the first time, was a form of social control. It wasn't pure altruism because they felt bad for poor people. They wanted to control poor people, control their movements, because they were afraid that maybe they would turn revolutionary if they were idle and were hungry. So, you know, and that motive is part of the welfare today. It's always been a form of social control of people who weren't quite trusted for freedom.
Well, and that was one of the talking points of the progressives in the last turn of the century, was that when the middle class had finally given rise to a big enough consumerist class, I guess, and started actually having leisure time and entertainment time, that was one of the original attacks of the progressives, right? That you shouldn't enjoy these benefits of the rich. That takes you away from being connected to the earth. In fact, they railed against electricity and indoor plumbing and all of that. And I guess the flaw in the market, or maybe it's a flaw in humanity, is that we're entirely too impatient. Like, the market never seems to work fast enough for these people, and then they make that error to where they say, well, we'll just put it on cruise control and we'll free people by violently enforcing our worldview on them, which just seems to be such a fallacy of reason. It's beyond my understanding.
No, I think that's a fair point. And they also, of course, didn't understand that the state was holding people back, because we didn't have laissez-faire. We didn't have a radical free market. We had, you know, the trappings of the market, some market institutions, but the state and well-connected owners of factories and big landholders always had privileges that the rest did not have, and that made people dependent on the system. So it was never a true, fully free market. I mean, even the what some libertarians regard as a golden age, the latter half of the 19th century, say from 1870 to 1900, you look closely, there's all kinds of transportation subsidies, the railroads, for example, beginning under Lincoln in the 1960s, and other forms of special interest legislation to the well-connected banking. Banking was never really free. And all of that helped to shape and try to guide and create a national market. And that's not free evolution of markets when you have the government and say big business, it's big business allies are trying to shape a national market. That's not the free system that we're talking about.
I could absolutely agree. I have like a bazillion questions for you, but so since you haven't voted, I did. My last vote was for Ron Paul. Actually, I never even got to vote because he was out by the primary. But I was still believing in 2012 that there was a chance, at least until Iowa, and you saw that catastrophe, that we may see a Ron Paul presidency. But I'm done voting. The only reason I'm going to maintain my registration to vote is that I hope somehow that I might be called on a jury and I might have the opportunity to nullify one of these stupid, horrible, bad laws, but I'll never vote again. And you haven't voted, you said, since 1980. So I wonder.
That's right. In 1980, I did vote for the Libertarian Party candidate.
Was that John Anderson?
That was Ed Clark. John Anderson was running as a third party candidate, against Carter and Reagan. But Ed Clark was the actual official Libertarian Party candidate.
So right on.
The last time I saw the inside of a polling booth.
Those are the days before the Diebold electronic vote counting machines. So let me ask you this then.
Those were also the days before most of the campaign finance laws.
That tried and failed miserably to take money out of politics. In fact, it just entrenched the incumbents further. Yeah. Unless you know how to fill out a phone book, you're probably not running for office. Yeah. But I wanted to ask you, so if...
Actually, I just realized that I sort of made an error. No, there was already campaign finance in effect, I think, beginning in the late 70s. So, yeah, that was a mistake. I'm going to fix it.
Oh, right. I thought the first ones actually emerged like in 72 or 73 were the first real pushes towards this. I don't know if you've ever run for office, but, man, trying to run for Congress it's insane, the amount of paperwork that you have to fill out. Like, a little person could never handle all of that paperwork, the financial reporting, and trying and actually campaign. So if voting is out of the question for you, and voting is out of the question for me, and many of my listeners, what are your thoughts on Bitcoin then, and what is a good solution for, do we just continue to push back and nullify on a personal level? What's the best way forward, since voting obviously isn't going to get us the change that we want.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ways, and people are going to think of ways that I don't, that I'm not thinking of. So it's really one of those open-ended things. Look, radio shows like yours is a way. Talking, writing, letters to the editor, just talking to your friends and family and neighbors. It's all kinds of things. The web, the internet, of course, has opened up huge and great avenues for us. And I think libertarians have used it very well. There's a commercial on MSNBC. It's a commercial for MSNBC on MSNBC that I have to laugh at in order to keep from crying. And the voice, I believe the voiceover is by Chris Hayes, who of course has a program on MSNBC. And it starts by saying, in America, there are many ways to express yourself. I don't know if you've seen this commercial. And then it says at the end of it's only like a 5 second, 10 second thing. It says, but only one way that counts. And you see a person coming out of a polling booth. And I'm thinking, that's what they think is the way, the only way to express yourself that counts. That's the way that counts least of all. You get one little drop in an ocean. And how does that count? Think of it. Most people cannot think of an election where if they did something else on election day other than what they did, the outcome would have been different. I defy anybody. If you live in a tiny town of 10 people, yeah, maybe. Maybe you can come up with an exception. But if you live in any kind of sizable jurisdiction, and certainly when it comes to president, Congress, the Senate, or something statewide, and most cities, it doesn't matter what you do on election day, you as an individual, the outcome is going to be the same. So that's the least way. And here's MSNBC trying to sell people on the idea that the only way that counts, the only expression that counts, is voting. How insulting is that? What are these people thinking?
Well, I would chalk that up to, the FCC's almost nearly 100-year-old rule called broadcast neutrality, where we're stuck with six large corporations basically owning licenses to 90% of what we read, see, and hear, right? I mean, one of the most profitable divisions of General Electric is their defense systems. And so they have to buttress the validity of the system, because how can this be a legitimate government? How can this be a legitimate government when this government claims that it can kill you, indefinitely detain you, torture you, and molest you without probable cause for any reason at any time in any place in the world? How can this still be a legitimate government that actually gets the consent of the governed, if not for the mind-numbing television signal?
Well, how can it be legitimate when so-called representatives are not representatives? I mean, the average congressional district has 600,000 people in it. I would like to know how a representative can represent 600,000 people, most of whom that person has never met before. So you have that problem. Then they go to Washington and they don't read the bills. So, and then they're voting supposedly on our behalf. So how can they be calling themselves representatives under those circumstances? And if they can't legitimately call themselves that, how can the government be considered legitimate? It's a big joke. It's a fiction. It doesn't have anything to do with what they teach us in the schools. That's just a fairy tale. It's propaganda to keep us, loyal. But as a thinker long ago put it, Etienne Labouetti, back in the 1500s, I think, the number of people ruled always way outnumbers the rulers, right? The rulers are always a very small minority in a society, and the people they lorded over are much bigger. So why do we let them get away with it? Why don't we just stop cooperating?
That's an excellent question. I wish more and more people would stop, withdraw. If I love the eloquence of the Declaration of Independence, and I no longer consent to be ruled by this murderous group of sociopaths in the District of Criminals. Yeah. I mean, they are outrageously, the things that they do in the name of whatever it is these days, it all comes back to the war state. And this is not the country that I was sold on when I was going through, elementary and middle school. I happened to grow up around the 200th anniversary of the Bill of Rights. But I mean, or the Constitution. This is so far gone from what this country was ever supposed to be. I can't understand why more and more people aren't withdrawing consent. But really, if we do, we have the numbers, right? Most Americans don't even bother to vote.
Yeah, but you see, and this sort of logical point, you can't withdraw consent. You're not allowed to withdraw consent, right? If you say I no longer consent, they still send you the tax bill.
Right, but that I don't. I don't.
They better pay it, or they're gonna. If they come and take you away when you haven't paid your taxes, they're not gonna. You can't say, "Well, I didn't consent," and then they say, "Oh, okay, sorry, we came to the wrong house." I guess. I mean, you can't.
Right.
You can't not consent. But if it's the case that you cannot not consent, then as my friend Charles Johnson likes to say, if you cannot not consent, you can't consent either. In other words, it's a logical thing. If there's no way to withdraw consent or refuse consent, there's no way to consent either. It goes together. So this is not a government by consent. It's impossible. It cannot be a government by consent.
Right. We are subjects of this this cartel of psychos that sit around and try to tell us how to live our lives. And But here's the thing, you know, like brute force doesn't like prove the point, right? I mean, if that's what they're going to do, for those people who refuse to obey Obamacare, are they going to throw everyone in jail? I mean, and people that are starting to use Bitcoin and getting away from the Federal Reserve note despite legal tender laws, really that just proves what a murderous, violent group of sickos that they are. And again, I hope people recognize that we have the numbers and simply just revolutionary acts of, you know, ignoring their existence, whether it is using Bitcoin on Overstock.com or whatever, seems to accomplish far more in my mind than pulling a lever for one of these corporate candidates.
Right, right. And turning to the other party is not an answer, which is, of course, part of what you're saying. Unfortunately, too many people think, we just need to get a Republican in there. And I watch these shows where I see people like Joe Scarborough say things like, I just want to win an election before I die. Who cares? What's the point of winning an election? It doesn't make any difference.
It makes you feel good, like when the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. Those people in them, they love the soap opera of Coke versus Pepsi, and well, now I guess Coke is on the outs, but it's always a soap opera. I mean, just a few years ago, my son's Rolling Stone magazine cover with Green Day on it then has at the bottom, I believe this one must have been 2008, whenever the Democrats took back over. And it was going to be great because now we were going to stop the war with, even though Bush was president. And then 3 years later, there's this another Rolling Stone cover, and it's the Tea Party Revolution. And things are going to change. And I don't know, watching modern day politics reminds me of watching soap operas with my grandmother. It's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. And if maybe one good will come out of Obama, that a whole bunch of young people will be finally disillusioned with party politics. And not turn to that at all, not see any hope at all. You know, so maybe that'll be the last hurrah for, you know, the young romantic who thinks, a candidate is the way to go. Hopefully it will sour them on that, and we'll start turning to other peaceful, I stress peaceful, ways of delegitimizing the state.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, and that's what I think is so revolutionary about these cryptocurrencies, whether you're a fan of Bitcoin or not. The notion of being able to purchase tangible goods without a dollar involved in the transaction is just that just blows my mind away that is actually taking place as we speak. People are conducting business. The world isn't imploding, and it's just one more hit against the U.S. petrodollar, which I wanted to talk to you about Iran, but we're running out of time. But I hope you will definitely come back on the show, and I wanted to give you a chance. What's the best way to keep up with Sheldon Richman?
Well, I post two articles a week at FFF.org. That's the Future of Freedom Foundation, so FFF.org. I have a blog, which is busy at times and busy sometimes not so busy, but that's SheldonRichman.com. It's called Free Association. And I'm on Facebook. Just look around for me and people will find me.
Excellent. Well, I do hope you can come back on sometime soon, maybe when we have some more developments with Iran. And because I wanted to pick your brain on that as well. But thank you so much for joining me this evening. It's an honor to have spoken with you, and I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
My pleasure, Allison, and please invite me back soon.
Will do. Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure you check out FFF.org. They have articles of Sheldon Richmond going all the way back to 1991.
You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.